and we had to explain it wasn't a weapon of mass destruction, but just a satellite dish.
I hardly ever got the famous 810 interview, which is the top interview of the day.
There was a great commotion outside, and guys from the police came in with guns.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Sue McGregor.
I was born in this country, in Oxford, during the war. I don't have strong memories of anything except the famous winter of 1947, I think, when pipes burst all over the UK. And after a rather miserable wartime for Brits, there was a really horrible winter as well, and there was rationing. My mother looked after me very well, and then my father came back from the war. And then he decided, I think, because he'd been there on a troop ship during the war, that Britain was too miserable. He said I'd had 13 wet weekends in a row as soon as I got demobbed, and I thought, having been born in the Far East, I would like to live somewhere else that's warm. We went out on a Union Castle mail ship, and one hadn't heard of apartheid in those days because it had barely been put into place. I have then another strong memory of looking out, seeing Table Mountain, which is a very beautiful way to enter Cape Town, and seeing black faces on the jetty side, men mostly in sort of boiler suits, helping unload passengers and luggage and everything. I really felt I was in an exotic country with warm weather, and I immediately took to it. My mother made my father swear that if she didn't like it, we'd go back after a year, and she didn't much ever like it, but we never went back. I learned to swim there, and I loved swimming when the breakers were crashing down on the Cape beaches. And I went to school, and I'm sure I had horrible times there from time to time. Didn't like the headmistress, and she was always upbraiding me for something. But I made a lot of good friends there that are still friends.
Can I do you now, sir?
My first memories of radio were, before we went out to South Africa, were of my parents. This probably was about 1948, were listening to something they adored and roared with laughter at while I was in bed, which was Itmar, It's That Man Again, with Tommy Handley. I also listened to Housewives' Choice and Workers' Playtime and all those. I think at that stage they were on what was called either the Home Service or the Light Service. There was no television to speak of in Britain, was there, in the late 40s? It had sort of stopped during the war. And when I got out to South Africa, there was absolutely no television, and that didn't come till about 1974, I think, because the increasingly right-wing and prohibitive South African government, nationalist government, decided that, or their Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, Dr. Herzog, decided that television was a bad thing to offer people of colour, black people, because they might see people of their own colour in positions of power over white people. Well, that wasn't quite what they said, but it was known as the sort of devil's box in white South African country society. So we didn't get television there for absolutely ages. So radio was king. That's what I listened to. At the age of 10, I was involved through my own fault in a car accident. I ran across a road not looking, and I was hit by a car. Fortunately, it was driven by a doctor, and I wasn't badly injured, but my vertebrae were dislocated, and I had to have medical treatment, and I had to lie flat on my back for about 2 months at home. But that was made enjoyable for me because I could listen to the radio, whatever I wanted to listen to. There were lots of serials on commercial radio there, and my favourite was Superman, which went on at 5 o'clock.
Presenting Superman.
And there were a lot of sort of soaps.
Up in the sky, look, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman.
The Heart of Juliet Jones, Mary Livingston, MD, I remember were the names. And it eventually occurred to me that they were not made in South Africa, but in Australia because of the accents. And I also got through the entire Arthur Ransom, because I was lying most of this time flat on my back, and I couldn't listen to what I wanted to all day on the radio. And I became a voracious reader as well. But radio I loved, and I used to enter radio competitions on SAB, South African Broadcasting Corporation, SABC Channel's English programme. And then Lorenzo Marx, as it was in those days, had, I think it was just called LM Radio, and all the pop stuff was on that, which I listened to, what we used to call the hit parade. my mother thought I matriculated, as it was known in South Africa, quite young at 16, and she thought I was too young to go to university. And she was probably right. I did go to the University of Cape Town at that age. And I discovered quite quickly I had no aptitude for making notes in lectures. I was just really too immature. So I went over to stay with relatives in England. I also was sent to Switzerland, not to a finishing school, but to a school where I could learn commercial French. Now, I'd learnt French at school. Why my mother thought commercial French would be useful to me, I do not know. Again, I made good friends there, English girls who'd been sent on the same course, six-monthly course. I loved Switzerland, and we could swim in the lake, and we could attempt to ski in the summer.
This is the BBC Light Programme.
I did get a very brief job, aged about 18 or 19, on the BBC Light Programme, which was then based in London in Bond Street, away from Broadcasting House, in a rather famous concert hall called Aeolian Hall. And I was secretary to the man who ran a programme called In Town Today, which was related to In Town Tonight, which was famous. It was always on radio, and it was about who was around. People were interviewed who were in town and famous. And I was a sort of secretary to the secretary on the programme, rightly, in a very junior position. But there was a man called Tony Bilbo, and there was a woman called Nan Winton, who was one of the first women actually to read the news on BBC television. And they interviewed people who were in town. I thought, oh, this is fascinating. You can meet famous people and you can ask them roughly any sort of question. And then all the producer has to do, and I never saw myself as anything other than a producer, is cut it down to size, whatever it should be, about 4 minutes. And it went out a few days later. I'd always worshipped the BBC from afar, almost literally, because my father listened to the BBC World Service. But in South Africa, in Cape Town, it was only delivered by very crackly shortwave. So he kept in touch with British and other news. He thought the BBC was a British asset to be cherished, and I rather took on this idea too. So I did want to work for the BBC. Eventually, I did. But I thought, they're not going to take me on as a totally inexperienced broadcaster, except at a very low level. I thought I'd only be working for them for a year, but I did work for 5 years for the South African Broadcasting Corporation in Cape Town from the age of 20. And here, my life changed utterly, because I was in the rather humble position of PA to the very nice woman who ran a programme called Woman's World, which was based, as the title suggests, a bit on Woman's Hour back in London. And she got engaged to be married and discovered, as in a lot of sort of civil service jobs, that she would have to apply for her own job again. And she thought, stuff this for a lark, I'm going to leave this job altogether. And Susan, as I was known, she can be on air temporarily while we find somebody else. Well, my boss, who was a very enlightened man for that age, he said, let's try Susan on air and see if she can do it. It means live broadcasting about 4 days a week, and she also has to find all the material for the programme. So this was an amazing opportunity for a young person who wanted to get into radio. I mean, I was being offered this on a plate. The chances were fairly high that I wouldn't be any good at it. And I was terrified at first, but it was fantastic training to have over 5 years. And when you're between 20 and 25, you've got bags of energy. So 5 years later, I got onto another of these mail ships and ended up in Southampton and then eventually sharing a flat in London. And I wrote a letter to the BBC, still radio's headquarters, very much Broadcasting House as it is today, and said, I've got this experience. I'd love to work for the BBC in any capacity you think I might be useful. Could you let me know if you'd like to talk to me? And about 3 weeks later, I got a letter back from the aptly named Brian Bliss, who was something to do with the Home Service. And he said, your experience is interesting, but what we need to know is what you can do with us. So we'll offer you a one-month holiday relief contract as a producer on what was then, I think, just becoming not the Home Service anymore, but Radio 4.
So, goodbye, Home Service. Two of the best words in the British language.
And in the news department, and I thought I didn't know anything about news, especially not British news. But what it involved was joining a programme on Radio 4, and it was called Southeast News. I wasn't on air or anything, but I was the producer. The editor of it, who ran the programme, was called Marshall Stewart, who went on to edit the Today programme. We were in a studio with the programme going out live on the fifth floor of Broadcasting House, and he was down on the third floor, and he kept changing his mind just before we went on air about what the running order should be. But instead of coming up or ringing, he would dispatch somebody with a note. And usually by the time you got the note of the change of running order, that item had gone out anyway. So it was quite a hairy 15 or 20 minutes. But that really was good training in acting fast and trying to sound confident when you're not, and making the programme begin on time and end on time.
In a few moments, you can hear Big Ben ringing out the old year and ringing in the new.
And it was still quite a formal place when I was there in the late 60s. Very formal. In fact, I remember there was some edict that Monica Sims, who was important on Radio 4, promulgated, which had to do with women weren't allowed to bring plastics shopping bags back through, having bought their stuff at British Home Stores, which in those days sold food as well as clothes. They couldn't bring their shopping back through the front door and towards the lift because that plastic bags were vulgar. You know, I think people had to obey that. People dressed quite formally. All the men went to work in suits. Now you don't, all these years later, 50 plus years later, you don't see a single man in a suit, certainly in Broadcasting House. There was this Latin motto above the front reception area. It was very Wreathian about, you know, I think it was the Latin version of nation shall speak peace unto nation. It was a bit longer than that. And that was all quite impressive. And there were commissionaires everywhere, with white gloves and sort of hats that looked as if they might have been ancient naval peaked hats. And some of them were disabled people from the war, and the BBC rightly had a sort of percentage of people that they had to employ who were disabled. Somebody who was in administration said that you could tell how important a person was when you visited their office by the colour of their carpet and by the soap in the loo nearby, because all these things were either very good or not so good, or that person doesn't matter in quality. Anyway, this one-month contract with Southeast News then blossomed into a three-month contract with The World at One. Andrew Boyle, who was then the quite famous editor, and Bill Hardcastle, who was the very famous front man for The World at One, were very bright and clever people.
But do you think a government should be frightened of people who want just to end the stream of pop? Isn't it for a government to act strongly and not be frightened by the segment of public opinion?
Bill Hardcastle was a large man who always seemed to be in a hurry, always looked a bit dishevelled, and wasn't your classic BBC broadcaster at all. He came from, I seem to remember, the Northeast, and he could sing Bladen Races with a Geordie accent beautifully. But he did have a standard, in those days, a standard BBC sort of RP voice. He spoke very, very fast. He didn't have a facility for foreign names. They often stumbled over them. And in those years, I remember, there were a lot of sort of Russian exiles who had to be named. They just got out.
An international campaign to publicise the case of the recently arrested Soviet human rights campaigner, Dr. Andrei Chair, I honestly can't pronounce this word very well, Chair Dr. Blobov.
But he was brilliant at contacts in America because he had worked for Reuters in Washington.
And I've seen the promised land.
I remember in 68, which was a year full of news and death, Martin Luther King was assassinated, and so was Bobby Kennedy, in quick succession. Bill decided that BBC correspondents in place in New York and Washington were good chaps, they were nearly always chaps, but not able to speculate. They were told they must only talk about what they know, which is a good rule in journalism, but it's not very lively radio. So he sort of invented Anthony Howard as a radio broadcaster because Tony Howard was working for The Observer in Washington. And he found all sorts of other people who could talk, sometimes on the spot, about something that had just happened, which the BBC, although I know from Ed Sturton's book about the BBC during the war. That did happen during the war, but that had rather fallen away, I think, by the 60s. And I remember when Teddy Kennedy and the Chappaquiddick incident happened, Bill said, let's get straight to the local police department and speak to the police chief about what he knows. Now, that was groundbreaking type broadcasting at the time, a phone call to a police chief. So the World at One became a real sort of lively program of this really is the world at 1 o'clock as we know it, and it needn't just be Britain, it will be the world, well, certainly the English-speaking world. And correspondents then had to change their tune a bit and talk more informally. That did, I think, give the BBC a new brand of foreign correspondent. And so that three-month contract then turned into an annual contract for 5 years, and I spent my early 5 years with the BBC that were important, hugely important for me, as a sort of girl reporter on what we called WATO, the World at One. And that was thanks to Andrew Boyle. He believed he had a team of his own reporters. They weren't from the newsroom. And he made his own little empire, and he didn't like BBC management at all and usually ignored what they told him to do. And one of these things was a team of six young people, three young women, three young men. But I knew nothing about news when I joined the team. And you learnt to work fast. In those days, everything was on tape, reel-to-reel tape, on small recording machines. And you edited with a razor blade, literally. There was a yellow pencil where you marked where somebody paused or coughed, or you could make them sound better. And I can remember editing with a razor blade and sticky tape, handing the tape to somebody who would rush into the studio when it was due to be broadcast in about 30 seconds. And somehow, it pretty well always worked. I don't remember any of my edits coming apart, although some unfortunate people theirs did. Mine was just luck, I think. So I never broadcast live on WATO, but I was a reporter. But my live broadcasting experience in South Africa helped me when I left World at One to join Woman's Hour as their new presenter after the famous Marjorie Anderson, who was a legendary woman.
I must confess, I missed the red coats and black bearskins of pre-war days because, of course, the guard was in khaki.
Marjorie Anderson had been doing it for a while, and I think people felt that the formula or the feel of the programme had to be refreshed. Good though Marjorie was, I don't think she really wrote her own scripts, and the interviews, to my surprise on my first day, were all rehearsed beforehand. I must have been about 30 then, which isn't that young anymore, but in those days it was young for a presenter of Woman's Hour. And on my first day, I did the programme as required, which was rehearse it. It was on at 2 p.m. in those days. Rehearse it in the morning in a studio down, it was called B9, it doesn't exist anymore, in the basement. Rehearse it in the morning, including the interviews, and then have what people in those days called a spot of lunch, which was quite sort of formal, white napery everywhere in a downstairs basement room. And I said to the producer, who was a man on that particular occasion, there was a man on the team, Anthony Derville was his name, and his speciality areas, because all the producers of Woman's Hour had speciality areas, his were makeup and fashion, which tells you something about Anthony, who we all adored. Anyway, I said to him at the end of the programme, could we try it tomorrow without rehearsing, just doing it? And the look of relief on his face gave me a sense of relief, because he'd obviously been wanting to do this for ages, but Marjorie didn't want to do it. So the next day, I did what I'd been doing in South Africa, which was daily live broadcasting. And I loved going live because the adrenaline flowed. And if you made mistakes, which you often did, you kind of found ways, either through a suggestion in your ears from your producer or just through your own initiative, of sort of making mistakes sound less bad than they were. And I considered I was incredibly lucky to get that job, because a lot of people would have killed for it, you know. It was a very good job for women broadcasters in radio in those days.
And now, Woman's Hour with Sue McGregor.
I've read articles by journalists saying, of course, Woman's Hour only became lively in the 80s and 90s. But actually, it was always a mould-breaking programme in its content, not necessarily in how the content was delivered. Because it started, I believe, in 1946. It was almost a sort of initiative from the government and the BBC, somebody was nervous about all these women who'd been working, all these married women who'd been working in factories and earning their own living and were essential to the war effort. They should really, it was felt by somebody on high, they should be going back to being housewives and mothers and, you know, producing new babies for the new generation. So Woman's Hour was invented as a rather cautious program, rather like a sort of comfortable club for women to send letters into and to hear about things that might go wrong in their lives, but nothing too drastic.
We wanted to get people onto the programs, not just professors and people who could read a good script.
But the women broadcasters seized this initiative like anything, and as management, somebody said, were generally still at lunch at 2 p.m., not many of them listened to Woman's Hour. And although the early programs, first 20 years really, now sound, especially with the voices, sound rather comically posh and proper, they did deal with subjects from lesbianism to husbands who stray, to transvestite husbands, to all sorts of medical issues that affect women. It was a really well-produced, slightly staid, but inquiring program for women, and people wrote in their droves, and there were readers' letters when I first joined the program, read out by two regulars, and you know, people had their opinions, which I think is slightly lacking in Woman's Hour now, broadcast on a twice-weekly basis, criticising the programme or saying they enjoyed something or suggesting stuff.
Hello. Today in the programme we have cookery, but from the printed page. In fact, we're going to look at the huge market for cookery books. And we visit Stoke Mandeville Hospital for spinal injuries. We learn about wallpapering well, and we have a short story by Charles Causley.
One of my most touching and one I'm most proud of having been able to set up was when Sandra Chalmers, who was editor of Woman's Hour in my last years there, to mark an important birthday of Woman's Hour, said, we'd like to send you to South Africa to talk to three South African women. And I said, well, we must try and, of course, get Winnie Mandela, who was under house arrest. Her husband was still very much on Robben Island in solitary confinement. We'll have to get a white nationalist politician as well, a woman. So I got the white nationalist woman. I can't remember her name. She spoke quite well. I got one of my heroines, Helen Suzman, who for many years was the only opposition member in the House who was against apartheid, in the House of Assembly in the Cape Town Parliament. And the third person to get was Winnie. I knew that Helen knew Winnie, and through her, I managed to persuade Winnie that I was okay and that I wouldn't duff her up in the interview and that I would come to her house in Soweto, just with a tape recorder, and I prayed that I could get it to work, because occasionally they didn't. And I stayed the night before in a hotel in Johannesburg. And the next day, I thought, how do I get into Soweto? Because I couldn't make any official plans, because journalists weren't allowed to visit Winnie in her home. I hailed a small, Americans call them bus boys, little guys with caps who help you with your luggage or take you to the lift or whatever, a little black boy. And I said to him rather quietly, I said, do you know where Mrs. Mandela lives in Soweto? Oh, he said, Mama Mandela. He was very impressed. And I said, would you care to come with me if we get in a taxi and drive that way? So he said, oh, yes, I'll come with you. I don't know how he got the morning off, but he did somehow. Anyway, he got in the taxi. He was only about 12 or 14 or something. He suggested another way in for the taxi driver to take us. And just before we got to Winnie's house, the boy said, stop here, because she often has either the police or the army parked outside her house with dogs. And we stopped, and taxi driver got out and said, they're there, but they'll go. He seemed to know the drill very well.
Out jumped a dozen men with guns and Alsatian dogs and demands for press credentials and permission to be there. Well, I thought it was.
And eventually they did go. And we edged our way around the corner. He dropped me quite quickly at Winnie's front door, which was, it was the front door of her garden, actually. The door into her garden, which was heavily secured with bolts on the other side. But she was expecting me, and I spoke to her through the intercom, and I went in. She was welcoming. We sat down in her living room, and I brought out my recorder. And I hadn't finished the interview yet, when there was a great commotion outside and dogs barking, and I thought, oh, they're back, and they were. She said, you know, hide your recorder, which I did under a sofa in her living room. Just as I'd finished doing that and sat myself on the sofa and thought, how do I explain myself? Some guys from the police came in with guns, and she said to me afterwards, you went quite white, whiter even than you are, having come from London. It was fine for me, you know, actually they do that every day to try and unsettle me. Anyway, they came in and they weren't interested in me at all, which surprised me. I think they thought I was a social worker or something. And the dog stopped barking and off they went. And that was when Winnie said to me, don't worry. And she came and gave me a big hug in the African way. And she said, let's continue the interview. And defiantly, she said, and let's continue it in the garden outside in case they come back. So this, I thought this was not a really great idea. But they didn't come back. I'm glad to say, because I had to ask her, I don't know whether people listening to this will remember that at that time in South Africa, Winnie was confined to her home, allegedly, first of all in the Orange Free State and then back in Soweto. She was still proselytizing in her township, Soweto, and she had a huge following. And at one point she made a defiant statement to a foreign television company saying, they said, you know, when do you think your husband will be released and when do you think eventually things will change in South Africa? And she said defiantly, with our necklaces and our matches, we will win. And what she meant by necklaces was, this was an awful way of the ANC and others would fill an empty car tire with petrol and put it round the neck of somebody who had either been conniving with the police or had done something they didn't approve of. They lit the petrol and this person burnt to death in the most horrible way. And I reminded her of this because it had only happened about 3 weeks before. And I said, what did you mean, Mrs. Mandela? Do you regret making the statement? And her eyes absolutely blazed. And I thought for a second, this was a big mistake. She's going to just kick me out.
You see, you made a remark the other day which upset a lot of people who otherwise admire you when you said, together, hand in hand, with our boxes of matches and our necklaces, we shall liberate this country. Did you really mean that?
I don't know where you get that quotation from. All I can suggest is you get the original...
But she did answer the question, and she said, we have been brutalized by the system. And to an extent, that excused some of the dreadful behavior, but certainly not assassination in that way. Anyway, I finished the interview, went away, and got somebody who I trusted to make a copy so that I could post a copy to the BBC, but also have it with me hidden in my suitcase, the recording, when I went back. Because if I was found with that, I would be asked questions and I might even have been arrested. I did get both the posted version of it and my own, clutched in my sweaty hand, got back to Woman's Hour, and it was broadcast about a week later. And Winnie's still around. She must be just about in her 80s now, still a very good-looking woman and still involved in politics. But she's never quite made it to the top in South Africa. She did have a ministerial job. But what happened was that she then became notorious for running a gang of young boys who she called her football team. And I'd heard the nascent version of that in the kitchen when I was recording the interview with her. And they went around, I don't know whether they necklaced them, but doing away with a certain number of young boys of their own age who they reckoned didn't have the right views. She denied that she had encouraged them to injure or kill people. But after that, her halo dropped dramatically. And she's never quite been able to sustain the sort of heroine whose husband was in jail image that she had before.
There must have been one wonderful moment for all of you when, for the first time, their father could hold the children, when you were allowed contact visits, I believe they're called.
A more generic memory of working on Woman's Hour, which was mostly a highly enjoyable experience, and I felt very lucky to be there, was when I was sent out to interview celebrities who were in town. In those days, one took for granted that somebody would set up the interview. It was between your bosses and their publicity people. And then you were just told to go along to whatever the hotel was in Park Lane and ask for them at reception, and you were shown up to their room, and it was just you and them. There was nothing like the team of people who surround No doubt at great expense to the stars themselves. The stars, I can't believe it when how difficult it is now to get interviews with people. But in those days, I can remember going to interview Ginger Rogers at very short notice. But other people I had much better success with. Julie Andrews. Again, it was just Julie and me and the U-Her tape recorder. And I pressed the wrong thing. And at the end of it, I said, I wonder whether we could just listen. I always did this, listen back to the interview. And I had the deeply embarrassing public experience of realizing that I hadn't recorded a thing. And although it was a 10-minute interview, this was 10 minutes, you know, another 10 minutes out of her busy day. And I'll never forget, she said to me, well, it's often better the second time, in true Mary Poppins way. So I did that again. But anyway, luckily, when I went to interview Betty Davis, she was playing a witch, I think, in a film aimed at children, but she was still Betty Davis, you know. And we were offered her as an interviewee on Woman's Hour. And she was staying in a hotel in Ascot. And we had a taxi driver who didn't know the way to Ascot. I did have a producer with me. And we were late, no mobile phones in those days. We just had to carry on. And we were about 40 minutes late for Miss Davis. And it was like being a sort of bit part in one of her former films. And there was this tiny figure at the top of a stair in this hotel, out of this hotel foyer, screaming at me, "You're late!" And I had to start the interview from that premise, you know. Went up the stairs, sat down, did a bit of chat with her, and she calmed down, and she was a very articulate and clever woman. She was wonderful. Got a terrific interview with her. And then she took out the gin bottle and said, "Stay with me for a bit, and I, you know, have a drink with me before you go back," which we did. And she told wonderful stories about her colleagues in Hollywood, which were not for recording on the tape machine. The trouble is, after a couple of gins and tonics, I couldn't remember any of them the next morning.
Have there ever been times in your life, and it seems hard to believe it now if it's so, but have there ever been times in your life when you have actually looked for work? Work hasn't come your way.
Oh, I've had many down.
I mean, it was a great honour to join the Today team in 1984. I first did it part-time, which was a sort of crazy result of Woman's Hour and the Today team disagreeing over what I should do with myself. And Woman's Hour, for some reason, didn't want to let me go quite at that moment. So for my first couple of years on Today, I was doing Today Mondays and Fridays only with Peter Hopday, which was enjoyable. Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday, I presented Woman's Hour, which was a sort of crazy combination, and it was completely exhausting. But anyway, by 87, I was full-time on Today. 87 was the year that John Humphreys joined. You know, one was in very, very good company there. The Today programme, for younger people who don't remember it, when it first started, it was famous for being presented by a chap called Jack DeManio, who was a trained chef, but didn't sound like a chef on air. He was just somebody who was a jolly fellow who enjoyed himself and had lots of male pals who knew what a good story was. It wasn't really a news programme, it was a magazine programme to get people out of bed with a smile. And in those early days on Today, and this went on for some time, there was a woman called Eileen Fowler who actually did radio exercises where people did physical jerks following Eileen.
And I'm rather hoping that the feminine members of the family will persuade the men to join in as well. Go. And knock and knock and down up.
And there was somebody on the organ who played tunes that were suitable to exercise too. And that happened at about 5 to 7 every morning. And Jack DeManio was famous not only for just being Jack and chap who enjoyed larks and that sort of stuff, but he never got the time right. And in the BBC archives, there are endless recordings of Jack saying it's 10 to 8.
But from the Today studio at just about 15 minutes... I can't read your writing. I've got a chap writing it out for me here, the silly fool, and I can't read his writing. Well, it's 16 minutes too.
So as soon as Jack was finally let go of, wisely it was decided that Today should be a proper news programme with journalists or former journalists as its presenters. It changed utterly.
And you're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Sue McGregor
and Peter Hobday.
It was a big jump from Woman's Hour to Today, I have to tell you, because although I'd had the World at One experience of news, it was nothing like the World at One, good though it is, doesn't have the audience that Today does. And Brian Redhead always used to say, one of the presenters in my first days there, I was lucky enough to work with Brian, although he was a difficult man. He used to say, working on Today is like having a whisper in the ear of the nation. You know that there are people from all walks of life, not just politicians and journalists, listening to every word that everybody says on that programme. Libby Purvis actually was the first woman to present Today at a very young age then. She was in her late 20s, I think. Very bright, very confident. She did an excellent job. Anyway, Yes, they weren't very friendly when I joined. Mind you, I did arrive at sort of 3:35 in the morning and they were busy making a programme. And somebody said, just sit over there. And in those days, no computers, there were just ancient typewriters. And you were sort of hot bunking with one of the researchers who'd been sitting there until midnight. You typed your script. But actually, I have a memory that you typed your linking script, which was the script, introducing each item yourself and with carbon paper copies to go to the producer. But in those days, we probably, as the two presenters, say it was John Timpson or Brian Redhead and me, you probably only did about 3 or 4 live interviews during the entire programme. The programme was a bit shorter in those days. It started at 6:30. Then as news became more competitive, as more other radio stations in the 70s and 80s, 80s and 90s started appearing, the Today programme became longer. And by the time I left, you could do anything up to 8 to 10 interviews sometimes in a day, and it was much more frantic. But in my early days, although they weren't very friendly at 3:30 in the morning, the team generally were very supportive. I had wonderful editors, including the egregious Rod Liddell, who was actually the best briefer for a political interview I've ever worked with. He was absolutely fantastic. He knew exactly what he wanted to get out of the interview and gave you useful information, which was background. And it took me a while to establish that, it seems ridiculous to say this now, that what they're looking for is something short and sweet and something that the person has never said before on air. They've got to get a news line out of it. If you interviewed somebody at 7:35 and it's on the 8 o'clock news, that is heaven for the producers and editors of the Today programme. And nowadays it happens as a matter of course, but it was slightly different, and there was more pre-recorded stuff, and there was an emphasis on sort of having a bit of fun and on the character of the presenters rather than on the content. And that all changed in the late 70s, early 80s, and it became much more of a hard news programme, and rightly so. And now it's a very hard news programme, but with light intervals in between.
Margaret Thatcher, when she was Prime Minister, was a daily listener, so we were told. We were also told she didn't always like what she heard. John Humphreys asked Lady Thatcher about her relationship with Today and with its best-known presenter.
I first met him when I was made Leader of the Opposition, and I was travelling around in Manchester, and he reported me then, and he was cheerful, he was ebullient, he was constructive.
I was lucky in that I'm single, I've never been married, I don't have children, therefore I could go to bed at sort of 9 o'clock and set the alarm for 3 a.m. And, currently there are two excellent women on the Today programme, and they both have families, and how they manage I do not know. So in a sense, it was more of a doddle for me than it was for other women on the programme. But I mostly loved every year on the Today programme. It was 17, I think I was on for about 17 and a half years. I still learnt a lot about broadcasting, and I learnt a lot about politics in those years. I don't know whether the present people feel this way, but I hardly ever got the famous 8:10 interview, which is the top interview of the day on Today. But I can see it, and there was one of the editors who was a brilliant editor and brilliant politically, Roger Mosey. When I asked him once why I was very, very seldom given the 8:10 interview, if it was a political one, he said, well, there's something about the theatre of John Humphreys with a top politician, and he ups his game, and he can sort of almost, he didn't use this word, but he can almost bully somebody into saying something they didn't mean to say.
He likes to catch them unawares, and he can continue as an equal, really, to them. He very much thinks of himself as an equal, to make this a sort of theatrical performance. And quite often, actually, in the days when there used to be head-to-head arguments between members of the Labour Party and members of the Conservative Party, which eventually were dropped for I don't know what reason. They were wonderful theatre as well. They were known as a good punch-up. And I think Roger felt, and he was probably right, that I wasn't quite the right person to stage this punch-up, either between two people or between the presenter and a politician. But somebody said to me, "But you're dogged." And I, in the end, possibly took about a minute longer, but I got there.
But as you'll know, Minister, there are not only complaints about what's happening to the benefit currently, but when it changes, it's going to be paid...
One of my worst moments was when the Today programme moved from Broadcasting House in central London to Television Centre, a.k.a. White City in Shepherd's Bush, which none of us wanted to do, and eventually, like the Grand Old Duke of York, the troops went back again to the beginning. But it did mean that a lot of the politicians didn't come in anymore, understandably, because they didn't want to brave the A40 coming back towards Westminster from that part of London and be late for an important parliamentary committee or whatever. So you interviewed them down the line, and the theatre wasn't quite as evident then. But also occasionally terrible things happened, like the wrong person in the studio. And I remember it was the interview just after Thought for the Day and before the weather, and that can be about a 6-minute slot. And this interview was about, there had just been a report from NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, as it was then, about too many wisdom teeth being extracted by British dentists. So I had, apparently, the president of the British Dental Association on the line down in Brighton, and a dentist who thought this wasn't a good idea in front of me in the studio at White City. And this man came in, slightly sweaty looking, I remember, but he sat down, and I nodded at him, nodded at me. There was live stuff going on, Thought for the Day. Thought for the Day finished, and I started my introduction into... I asked the question first of the man in front of me, and I asked him about why he felt that this was a bad idea, too many wisdom teeth being extracted. And he gave me a smile and a shrug, as if he made it perfectly plain he had nothing to say about this. And I looked through the glass at my producers and researchers and everything, and I mouthed, "Who is this?" I think they didn't know who he was either. So I thought, well, I must have asked the question of the wrong person. So I asked the question of the man down in Brighton, and he said, "Yes, I am the president of the British Dental Association, and this is what I have to say about it." And then I went back to the other guy, and he still had nothing to say, and we still had about 5 minutes to fill. And I realised that whoever he wasn't the right person. Anyway, the poor chap in Brighton happily filled the 6 minutes. And then came the weather forecast. At that moment, I dashed out of the studio, went into what we called the cubicle, other side of the glass, and I said, "Who is this man?" And they said, "We have no idea. And what's more, he doesn't seem to speak English." And he turned out to be a Russian who had picked up a taxi at Paddington and said, in the only English he knew, "Take me to BBC.
Well, 23 minutes past seven, and on the line is the Social Security Minister, Nicholas Scott. Mr. Scott, it seems that the benefits agency...
Well, when I did get the chance to talk to politicians, I always enjoyed it. There were some who were really tricky to talk to, and others who were always a joy because they were sort of cross first thing in the morning, particularly Claire Short, Labour MP, and she was the Development Minister, as I recall, for quite a long time. Claire always said it like it was, and she was generally cross about something, so she was always good, as it were, copy for broadcasters. She was also lovely to meet informally because she was jolly and not at all the rather spiky person that she was on the Today programme. I greatly enjoyed, in my early days on Today, talking to South African politicians of literally all colours and persuasions, because I felt this was an area that I was pretty comfortable with. I did enjoy acting as chairperson between two MPs. There were certain MPs who were rather disdainful towards women, and Dennis Healey was one, especially when woken up early in the morning and when he was in a studio, let us say, in Moscow or somewhere like that. And after all, it wasn't that early, and he was about 4 hours ahead of us, but he was still grumpy on the phone, but always gave good copy, always said something interesting. But Brian Mawhinney, an Ulster Unionist MP, wasn't terribly good with women. I'm sorry to say this, Brian, if you're listening to this. He was a little bit disdainful, maybe rightly, of my right to ask him some questions, and he accused me of asking him smeary questions, which I thought was a great adjective. One felt he wanted me marched out of the studio and sent to jail for a couple of weeks after the interview.
Don't be ridiculous, Sue.
Dr. Mawhinney, thank you.
But do you remember the sort of ones where you felt a genuine sense of danger, perhaps, even better? And I remember quite clearly being dispatched by my bosses to Londonderry, or Derry, very important what you call it according to what your politics are, to interview Martin McGuinness, who had announced he was about to stand as a Sinn Féin MP. McGuinness would only agree to talk to me if we did this live, and it was winter time, in a car park, which he named. And I did have a producer with me, and we were under the Derry city walls, I remember, and there were actually British Army guys patrolling. You could just about see them with their rifles cocked about 50 feet above us. And from memory, the time he was due to speak to me was about 10 to 7 in the morning. It was absolutely pitch dark and had been raining. And it was very spooky in that car park. One of my rather inconsequential thoughts was, do we shake hands? Because he had a role earlier on in a BBC television documentary, which caused a lot of problems for BBC management. But anyway, at 11 minutes to 7, he still hadn't arrived. But 30 seconds before 10 to 7, this shadowy figure came out from between two black cars and came up to me. He stuck his hand out and I shook his hand. I mean, it sounds ridiculous in these days of better relations between everybody in Northern Ireland. Let us hope that lasts. That one had this worry about, do I shake hands? But I did. And he gave a very good interview and then melted away into the dust. And on the same trip, I did an interview with Ian Paisley in his home. And I remember we planted the satellite dish, in that case, in his back garden. And I can remember Mrs. Paisley looking out saying, what's that? And we had to explain it wasn't a weapon of mass destruction, but just a satellite dish.
These are truly remarkable scenes taking place here tonight on the eastern side of the Berlin Wall at Checkpoint Charlie. Hundreds of people have gathered here in the hope of getting across in the light of the...
Well, I remember in the late 80s, we dealt a great deal with Eastern Europe because all sorts of things were happening there. Communism was crumbling. And every Monday morning, there was an interview set up with the pastor of... I think it was the Thomaskirche in Leipzig, outside which there were always demos on Monday against the East German communist regime, and the pastor was on the side of the demonstrators, and he spoke good English, so what's not to like about that? So there was always this interview which was quoted for the rest of the week about where they thought they were in terms of negotiating away from the communists. I remember one morning coming in at the usual time, very early, 3:30, 3:45, and they were saying, the Berlin Wall's coming down. We had a reporter there, and the whole morning was devoted to this momentous occasion. And people were on air talking to us in broken English, because the East Germans didn't speak English as well as the West Germans did, with people who were watching it come down. And Graham Leach, who was the reporter there, who was sort of sitting on the wall watching bits of it being gouged out. And he was wonderful giving us the word picture of these machines that you usually see on houses being pulled down, pulling the rubble away, pulling bits of the Berlin Wall away. And I think that was one of the most exciting moments.
The police commander on duty here at Checkpoint Charlie has suddenly announced that they can go over, even though they may not have the right documents, and they're simply...
There were sad moments too, the death of Nelson Mandela, but earlier on, the release of Nelson Mandela was a wonderful moment. It was known about in advance, and I was jolly cross because John Humphreys was sent to do it, and it wasn't me. But never mind. Yes, there were moments of joy, but mostly moments of sort of apprehension when you felt the world was changing.
The higher you build your barriers, the
taller I become.
Radio made a very good fist of me. You know, these were all brilliant stories for television, of course, but radio could, with good reporters, make it just as fabulously interesting, and through good reporting, people listening could see in their mind's eye what was happening.
But I'd like to say goodbye to listeners. I hope I'll be back in some capacity, not on this programme, but, you know, on something
else. Well, they're not so retiring, are you?
Well, no.
You could be just stopping doing the today.
Absolutely not.
Well, I mean, why and, now, Sue?
I remember crashing the pips right at the end. Crashing the pips means you do occasionally still hear it. When the boop, 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 boop into the news bulletin, at the beginning of it, somebody's talked too long. But I don't think I'd ever done that in my 17 and a half years, except on the last day, because the team set up a wonderful farewell with me, which I knew nothing about really, which involved Jim Naughty being there and John Humphreys being there and the odd glass of champagne and some unexpected sort of funny stories that they told at the end. And I was overwhelmed by that. And had I not been on air, I might have been a bit tearful, and my joyous discomfort was indicated by the fact that I crashed the pips.
Our editors were, and I can't even remember who they were. Oh, they were Victoria and Nick. Goodbye.
And then afterwards, there was a lovely party they gave me. And there was also a party that they gave for a sort of seeing off party at, of all places, the wonderful Wallace Collection in central London. And Rod Liddell, who was the editor at the time, gave a great speech. And he, one of the things he said I'd forgotten about, one of the less popular assignments for Today presenters was to actually do the party conferences every year, which happen sort of September, October every year, which means spending about five, used to mean maybe spending 5 days in Blackpool. I've got nothing against Blackpool, but, you know, it was not a necessarily a very popular job, because you were away from home for quite a long time. And the editor said to me, who would you like as your producer? And I said to him, anybody but Rod Liddell, and I named another person, who I won't name on air now. And he said, fine, and I didn't get either Rod Liddell or another person. And this was a ridiculous thing for me to say, because actually Rod Liddell, as I've indicated earlier, was one of the best political briefers in the business. And I got to know him better, and I got to like him a lot, and he always made me laugh. Anyway, when I had my farewell party, Rod Liddell was the editor of the programme by then, not a mere producer. And he told the story against me. He said, do you remember when you said anybody but Rod Liddell? And anyway, that was told quite rightly against me, and everyone roared with laughter, and it was a good party, and I really didn't feel I deserved something quite as nice as that, but I got it, and it was lovely.
Mornings at 4 o'clock aren't going to be the same without you, if everyone can please try not to misunderstand that. But
I miss the sort of panic moments and the adrenaline rush, which happened almost every day. I miss live broadcasting enormously. I love doing the programme I still do twice a year called The Reunion. I love doing that, but it is of necessity recorded. Yeah, and I miss the gossip and the companionship. There's always great, as all journalists know, you know, get four journos together, and I'm a very amateur journalist still. There's always good crack, as they say in Ireland. So I miss all that. What I do not miss is the early hours, the ghastly hours. And somebody said to me 3 weeks after I stopped getting up at 3 a.m., well, you've dropped probably about 10 years, actually, because you always looked about 10 years older than you were. There you are. It's not for me to say that, but I did feel a sense of release when I left. But I listened to the Today programme devotedly as a regular listener, you know, and sometimes I shout at the radio, as all Today listeners do, and sometimes you can hear what's gone wrong and you sympathise with producers and with presenters. But it's an absolutely essential part of my morning drill, I have to say. I hugely enjoyed working on The World at One for reasons that you may guess at from what I've just said, which is about, you know, journalists make really good company, and there's always a lot of good gossip, and there's a lot of fun, as well as good hard work. And I learned about that on The World at One way back in the late 60s.
And then working on Today live for the same reasons. And I was part of a team. And it's interesting, I think, how the different pairings you get on the Today programme actually inform the whole feel of that day's pairing, whether it's... And it was very rarely two women together in my day, just occasionally, and so occasionally that I remember the Daily Mirror came and sent a photographer to see two women presenting the Today programme. Didn't happen again for years. But yes, there is a subtle difference, I think, if you're a regular Today listener to the pairings, and that's always rather fun.
It's 6 o'clock on Thursday, the 22nd of August. Good morning. This is Today with Brian Redhead and Sue McGregor.
I'm really grateful to the BBC for hanging on to me for a long time, because I suppose it's now... I mean, I've worked for the BBC for over 50 years now. My gosh, I'm very lucky to have done that. And I hope with the reunion, you know, this will continue for a bit longer until they decide it's time for the old girl to, you know, go.
The Glastonbury Festival of Music is a British summer...
I do still miss live broadcasting, and I'll never be offered another chance of live broadcasting apart from maybe, you know, the odd interview in somebody else's programme. But I do miss that chance, and if Charlotte Green ever stopped reading the football results on Five Live, well, you know, they could make me an offer. I have one tiny regret in my career. People have sometimes said to me, have you ever thought of working in television? I've said to them, yes, and one opportunity, one or two, did present themselves. But I'm really somebody who prefers not to get recognised in the street, and it takes away your private life. Lee Remick, alas no longer with us, Hollywood star, she was over here making a movie, and somebody went roaring up to her saying, you're buying food in Safeway or whatever. I was once asked by the splendid Desmond Wilcox if I'd like to join the team of one of his weekly programmes as a presenter. And I thought about it and thought about it. And A, I thought very practically it would probably only be a 13-week assignment. And in those days, programme editors were very jealous of their presenters. And I knew if I left Woman's Hour to join television for 13 weeks, it might be a matter of regret. I have done the odd... There was a very tiny mini-series called My Kind of Movie that I did on BBC Two, which I enjoyed doing. It was asking famous people what their most favourite movie was, and it gave a chance to play little clips from that movie. Ted Heath's was Kind Hearts and Coronets, and that very fact made me think a lot more of Ted Heath than I'd thought before. But otherwise, I've done very little television, and I'm happy that way. I'm conscious of being very lucky in that I haven't had domestic reasons to sort of break my career from time to time, and I do admire the women who've managed to do that through childbirth and everything else. So I don't think I'll necessarily be remembered for anything in particular other than being there a very long time, and that's fine by me.